I wonder what what's on your must-have list on an Easter day. Maybe you must be at church. I guess that's a reality for many of you. Maybe you must be with family. Maybe you must have roast lamb. Maybe you must not have roast lamb because you don't really like it. Maybe you must have Easter eggs. There's all sorts of things that we feel we must have. Maybe even at church, there's certain hymns that we feel like we must sing every Easter Sunday. Otherwise, it won't be a real Easter Sunday. There must be certain readings, whatever it may be. I was, as you might have noticed, I've had a haircut since Good Friday. I was at the hairdresser's yesterday, and my barber's Romanian. And he was telling me, firstly, he outed me and said, "Oh, you're getting your hair cut for Easter Sunday, are you?" Yes, that's true. And then he proceeded to tell me all of the traditions that Romanians, and particularly Romanian Orthodox people, have around Easter. And there were lots of great ones. They weren't allowed to eat on Good Friday, but he did confess to me that he sometimes snuck some food on Good Friday, which I told him was okay, but we didn't do that. He was telling me about the eggs that you had to paint, and that on Easter Sunday, no matter how well decorated those eggs were, you had to smash them on the head of the members of your family. There were so many things that your Easter Sunday service was not at 10:30, it was at midnight. You had to go to the church, and there was this long trail of candles and knocking on the door. There's clearly some very different traditions surrounding Easter in Romania. And maybe there's other people here from different countries. It'd be interesting to find out what your Easter traditions are. But there is a question about what is absolutely essential. During the conversation, he said to me, "When we go to church, we have to light a candle for Easter." And he said, I've got a question for you. I've been told by my priest in Romania that you must... If you can, you must light your candle with a candle that was lit in Jerusalem. But if you can't do that, you've got to use a match. You can't light a candle with a lighter. But I was thinking, would Jesus really care about that? What do you do at your church? He was a bit shocked to find out that we use electric lights on Easter. That didn't really matter. And I said, well, what we try to do is we just try to focus on what Jesus said is of first importance for Easter. Dan read to us from 1 Corinthians 15 before, and Paul, one of Jesus' followers, records what is of first importance, not just for Easter Sunday, but for all the time for Christians. He says, "What I received, I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day, according to the scriptures." That's more important than Easter eggs. It's more important than smashing eggs on people's heads. It's more important than what time we have a service or whether we light candles or not. Those things are of first importance. Jesus died for sins. He was buried. He was raised on the third day. And all that was in accordance with the scriptures. We covered Jesus dying for sins on Good Friday. I know most of you were here then. Dan tonight is going to talk a little bit about what it means with according to the scriptures. But we need to look at the other two there. The other two things that were of first importance. Jesus was buried. Perhaps that wouldn't be first on your list of things that are most important. But it really matters. Every gospel tells us that Jesus was buried, who buried him, and where it was that he was buried. Why is that so important? And Jesus was raised. The Easter story isn't some myth added at a later point. It is vital that we know that Jesus really did get out of a grave and take up his life again. So this Easter Sunday, there is nothing you can do better than to hear and to meditate on those truths. Jesus was really buried and he really raised. Why? Well, we're going to see three lessons for each of those two events. First of all, we're going to look at three lessons from Jesus' burial. I'm going to quickly summarize what happens in the story, and then I'm going to draw out the three implications from Jesus' burial. So we ended on Good Friday with the gruesome description that a spear was thrust in Jesus' side and blood and water poured out. That doesn't happen if you're alive. Jesus is really dead, as Liz has already told us. The Jewish leaders were keen that bodies not be left out on the Sabbath because it was Passover the next day. A million people would descend on Jerusalem. It would be like having a criminal hanging from Big Ben on New Year's Eve or something like that. They just couldn't have that. As we've seen a couple of times, if you've been here over the past few weeks, the Pharisees are scrupulous about the minor points. They would have no doubt had opinions on where you light your candle, but they forget what's most important. Anyway, it does raise the question, what's going to happen with Jesus' body? The usual sense of things, the usual way that crucified victims were buried is they were thrown into an open grave where all the criminals would be unceremoniously dumped. But verse 38 tells us something different happened. Later, Joseph of Arimathea asked Pilate for the body of Jesus. Now, Joseph was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly, because he feared the Jewish leaders. With Pilate's permission, he came and took the body away. Now, there wasn't a lot of time between Jesus' death and when the burial had to be finished before the Sabbath started. In Jewish time, you start the new day in the evening rather than in the morning or in the middle of the night, as we think of. So there was a matter of hours for him to do this. So we figure out from that Joseph must have been there at Jesus' death. He must have watched it for himself. And when he did that, something changed within him. He didn't want to be a secret believer anymore. He wanted to serve Jesus one last time. We learn from the other Gospels a bit more about Joseph of Arimathea. All of them tell us about him, but each of them give different details. We already read before in the children's talk that Joseph was rich, which explains why he had this expensive gravesite in Jerusalem, and he had the wherewithal to buy these spices. Luke tells us he was actually part of the council that had put Jesus to death, but had opposed the decision. So actually, he decided to out himself as a believer a few hours earlier. And as we've said, John emphasizes for us that he had been a secret believer up to that point. But now he's taking the risk to publicly show that he follows Jesus. But he wasn't the only one. Verse 39, he was accompanied by Nicodemus, the man who had earlier visited Jesus at night. Nicodemus brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 35 kilograms. Nicodemus was another secret believer, but over the course of John's gospel, he's got progressively more and more brave. So in John 3, he wants to speak to Jesus, but he comes at night and he doesn't let anybody know about it. In John 7, he's in the Jewish council, where Joseph also would have been, and he criticizes the other leaders for judging Jesus before hearing whether he's innocent or not. So he's a little bit more brave. And now he decides to help Joseph of Arimathea bury the body of Jesus. We carry on in verse 40. Taking Jesus' body, the two of them wrapped it with the spices and strips of linen. That was in accordance with the Jewish burial customs. At the place where Jesus was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, a new tomb in which no one had ever been laid. Because it was the Jewish day of preparation, and since the tomb was nearby, they laid Jesus there. There were no coffins in Jesus' day as there are in ours. He was wrapped up. He had spices placed within the wrapping to keep his body smelling fresh. They had only a short time between the crucifixion and burying Jesus, but they were close to the tomb. Everything was completed on that Friday. And no one would be able to come and see that tomb until the Sabbath was over, which would have been on Sunday. That's what happened. What's the significance of this? Well, there are three lessons from Jesus' burial that we need to learn. Firstly, Jesus' burial proves he died. Secondly, Jesus' burial fulfills the scriptures. And thirdly, Jesus' burial encourages risky discipleship. First, Jesus' burial proves he really died. Some people wonder if Jesus maybe survived miraculously the cross. Maybe he passed out and he woke up in the grave and people thought he'd raised from the dead, but it was just a coma or something like that. But all of the contemporary accounts of Jesus agree that he died, whether they're written by Christians, by Jews, or by Romans. However, when John's writing his gospel, this is a few decades after Jesus came, and a group are beginning to appear, we can see from his letters, that believe that God would never take on human flesh. So they believe Jesus just appeared to be human. And so John is countering this. And we saw that on Good Friday, didn't we? The description of the blood and the water coming out is to say, he really did die. I saw it with my own eyes. I saw the blood and the water. He was a flesh and blood human. Now, today we don't have many people who think that Jesus came in a sort of ghostly form. But there are certainly Muslims who believe that Jesus just passed out on the cross. And some have even wondered whether it really matters if Jesus really died or not. Maybe it's just an inspiring myth that was created, which kind of ran away with things. Well, it's apparent that John definitely believed this happened. When you read myths from the first century, they don't include all of these random details John has. The names of people, historical figures that we know of, the weight of spices, the place he was buried, the way Jewish people buried their dead. It's not a mythological story. It's recounted as history. And the stories of Joseph and Nicodemus give us ample reason for believing that Jesus really did die. In taking down that body, wrapping it in linen and spices, carrying it to the tomb, they're going to have a lot of contact with that dead body. They will know that this man is really dead. And they've not snuck Jesus off in the night, remember. At great risk, they asked Pilate for the body, and Pilate checked with his professional soldiers that Jesus was really dead, because he knew this was a dangerous man. He could get into trouble with the Jews if the body disappeared. And this explains why none of Jesus' opponents, among the Jewish leaders or the Romans, ever argued that Jesus didn't die. And that's important, because it means God did take on human flesh. He did die, really die. He really was tortured. He really gave up his spirit. The sacrifice was really and truly made. If it was just a story, then your sin hasn't really been paid for. And God didn't really love you enough to suffer on the cross. But if this did happen, then you know God loved you enough to suffer and die. And you know your sin was really paid for. Jesus' burial proved he really died. It also fulfills the scripture. This is a bit briefer, but let me share it with you. Isaiah 53 verse 9 prophesied 700 years before of the Messiah. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death. He was buried in a rich man's grave. And so he was buried with the rich. What are the chances of that? Jesus couldn't arrange that after he's dead. Both crucified like a criminal and buried with the rich. God prophesied 700 years beforehand these things that no one could have faked. But finally, Jesus' burial encourages risky discipleship. Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, to this point, had been secret believers. While they may have occasionally gone to hear Jesus speaking in the temple, or they might have occasionally given a little comment in the Jewish council, generally they weren't willing to put their necks on the line. And yet, on Good Friday, enough was enough for them. They decided they were permanently going to associate themselves with Jesus. And what a time to decide to go public. Neither of them expected Jesus to rise from the dead. They wouldn't have gone to the effort of getting all of these cloths and spices and carrying him to a grave. As far as they were concerned, Jesus was dead, not coming back. But how amazing is it that in Jesus' death, there was more impact upon them than in his life? They permanently decided to out themselves as disciples of him. Their story is meant to be a model for us as well. Many of John's readers would have felt the fear of Joseph and Nicodemus. Whether they were Roman Christians or Jewish Christians, there were Christians all over having their property stolen from them, having their families kick them out, even being put to death. Some of the apostles, John's own friends, were being killed at this time. Many believers reading this gospel might have been tempted to keep it a secret. And for those examining the claims of Jesus, it might have seemed a huge risk to even read about this dangerous man. Nicodemus, I think, is meant to be a picture for us in John's gospel, of what John wants us to do as we go through. Maybe at the start, coming to Jesus in secret, seeing if he really is who he says he is. In John 7, maybe stepping out a little bit. But now he wants us, like Nicodemus, to decide once and for all, I will follow him. Now, as far as I'm aware, none of us in this room are going to face death for our faith. But it can be hard to reach the point to outwardly say, I am a Christian. It's always at risk, but it's always one that is worthwhile. To be buried with Jesus in baptism is to say, he died that death for me. To say, he is my saviour. Those are hard things, but they're vital things. John felt it was vital, even with all the risks to the people he was speaking to, that they, like these men, publicly testify that they believe in Jesus. And how much more should it be the case with us? If you've been convinced that Jesus is God, don't delay any longer. Don't keep it a secret any longer. Make the bold risk of telling the world that you are his disciple. Jesus' burial proves he died, fulfills the scripture, and encourages risky public discipleship. Now let's look at three lessons from Jesus' resurrection. Actually, John has a lot to say about Jesus' resurrection. If you're just here as a one-off, we're actually going through John on Sunday mornings, week after week. So we're going to be looking at some other appearances of Jesus that John tells us about in the coming week. So there is more to say than all that is mentioned in verses 1 to 10. But for now, let's look at three lessons from John 20, verses 1 to 10. We read this. Early on the first day of the week, which is Sunday if you're Jewish, not Monday. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. Who was Mary Magdalene? It's actually quite hard to pin that down because there were a lot of Marys in Jesus' time. Sometimes we have confusion in our house when we talk about a Jean and the kids are like, oh yeah, that Jean who gave us some stickers. No, no, the other Jean. And too many Jeans in our church. And there's other names like that as well. Well, it was the same with Mary in that time. This isn't Mary, the mother of Jesus, nor is it Mary, the sister of Lazarus. A lot of people think that. Nor is she a prostitute, contrary to what some Pope said in the 500s AD, which has continued to this day. And she's certainly not Jesus' secret girlfriend, for those who have watched the Da Vinci Code. No, she's a part of a group of women who supported Jesus' ministry financially. The only thing we know about her before the death and resurrection of Jesus is that she had seven demons cast out of her and that she gave money to support Jesus. So she's a woman who was forgiven a lot and who was invested in Jesus' mission a lot. She's held up as a great example of faith. And no doubt that led her to want to care for him in his death. And we know from the other Gospels that there were other women with her who wanted to do the same. The tomb had a large stone rolled in front of it, so it wasn't easy to get in. And Matthew tells us it was sealed with an official Roman seal, making it clear it shouldn't be tampered with. And as we heard, there was a guard in place there, supposedly. It would have been very hard to steal a body. But Mary went and found no stone, no seal, and no guards. So Mary jumped to the conclusion that Jesus had risen from the dead, right? No. Verse 2, so she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, and said, they've taken the Lord out of the tomb and we don't know where they've put him. She assumes what any normal person would have assumed when they found an empty grave. She didn't jump to the conclusion Jesus had risen from the dead. She assumed Jesus' enemies, for some unknown reason, wanted to take him from the tomb. Maybe they wanted to display him for public disgrace on the walls of Jerusalem. So she runs and tells two of Jesus' disciples, Peter, who denied Jesus three times, and the disciple Jesus loved, which is John, the author of the Gospel, who, as we've said a number of times, he never names himself out of humility. But we will see a little thing that's not quite so humble in a few moments' time, which is this. So Peter and the other disciples started for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. So it's good to know that John wanted to record for all of history that he is faster in a foot race than Peter. But anyway, that's just a little small fact. The most important thing was what John did next. He bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. Now, those strips of linen are more important than they might seem. Remember, they're wrapping round the body. If you're stealing a dead body, do you want to strip it naked and carry it through the streets? Absolutely not. You would keep those linen cloths so that you don't have to touch a disgusting dead body. So who on earth has any motivation to take off those strips? Verses 6 to 7. Then Simon Peter came along behind him and went straight into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the cloth that had been wrapped around Jesus' head. The cloth was still lying in its place, separate from the linen. Jesus wasn't like some of us who just throws things on the floor when he takes them off. He takes them off and puts them to one side. That's the only logical conclusion. Who is stripping this body naked and tidily putting it to one side in the tomb, perhaps to be used by someone else who might actually need them? Verses 8 to 10. Finally, the other disciple, John himself, who had reached the tomb first, just to remind you of that, he reached the tomb first, also went inside. He saw and believed. They still did not understand from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead. Then the disciples went back to where they were staying. John, whilst he does want to emphasize that he got there first, he is honest in saying that he was a bit nervous about going into the tomb. And actually, he didn't believe until he went in and saw it for himself. And even then, he hadn't understood what Jesus had said on countless other occasions, as Liz has already told us. He'll have more explained in coming meetings with Jesus face to face. But for now, he believes Jesus is risen and not much else. He is completely clueless about what's going on. And to find out a bit more, you'll need to come back over the next few weeks. But looking at this passage, what are three things we can learn from the resurrection here? Well, first, Jesus' resurrection was unexpected. Second, Jesus' resurrection really happened. And thirdly, Jesus' resurrection transformed cowards. First, Jesus' resurrection was unexpected. No one was sitting around waiting for Jesus to come back. Mary jumped to the conclusion the body had been stolen. John and Peter, even after seeing the evidence, hadn't put everything quite together. John tells us a number of times in the Gospels that Jesus did foretell his resurrection, but he's quite honest that they didn't understand what he was on about. This resurrection was unexpected, and that's important because one way people explain away the resurrection is to say, well, maybe there was just some psychological problem with these tortured disciples. They've gone through a tragedy and they just want to see Jesus risen. They're expecting to see him risen. So they put two and two together and make five. And it's understandable, but it's not really real. And we've got to understand that. But they weren't expecting him to come. They weren't sitting waiting for this final victory. They expected him to be dead even after they had evidence to the contrary. And we'll see with Thomas that that went a very long way in a few weeks' time. They were not expecting Jesus to raise, which is one among many reasons why we can be convinced that Jesus' resurrection really happened. As we've said before, John is determined to make clear that this is not a myth. Jesus was not a spirit. Nor did he rise in some sort of ghostly form to people. He took off his grave clothes because he was in the same body that was wrapped in them. And he wasn't saying Jesus lives on in our hearts. He was saying he really did physically rise from the dead. And ever since, there have been many people trying to explain away why the disciples thought Jesus had raised. But none of those explanations stand to scrutiny. Let me quickly run through some of them and we'll revisit them over the next few weeks. We've already examined what's called the swoon theory, that Jesus swooned, which, you know, makes him sound like some sort of Elizabethan lady. But no, that he passed out on the cross and seemed to resurrect. Well, the piercing by the Roman soldier, the burial with Joseph and Nicodemus show it is very unlikely. Not to mention that a crucified man is going to need some medical attention, lying in a tomb for 3 days. He's not going to magically reappear and be able to fight off some soldiers and move a stone away. Another theory is that Jewish leaders stole the body. That's the conclusion Mary jumped to, isn't it? But what do the Jewish leaders stand to gain from this? When the disciples are running around Jerusalem saying, Jesus is risen from the dead, surely they could have said, no, he isn't. Here's the body here. And more than that, why would they strip off a dead body to take him away and bury him somewhere else? Other people think this was never meant to be taken as a literal fact. It was always a myth showing Jesus living on in our hearts. But again, we've seen John is clearly writing a history, telling us all the details. He gives the names of real people and lots of details that just don't make sense in a myth. The most popular argument in the first century was that the disciples stole the body, which we saw already in the children's talk. And that brings us to our third lesson, and perhaps the most convincing proof of the resurrection. Jesus' resurrection transformed cowards. Peter had forsaken Jesus. John at least was there on the cross, but he was hardly out fighting the good fight on that Easter Sunday morning. He was hidden away with Peter as well. These men were reduced to nothing. Yet in a few months, they would be proclaiming to the world this message. They themselves, Peter and John, would stand before that Jewish council that put Jesus to death and accuse those men of putting the Messiah to death. Where did they get that confidence? Did they make it up? Well, what's the motivation? If they were going to be plied with money, fair enough. But they were beaten, imprisoned, and killed. Within the year, these two men are going to be flogged and threatened with death. At some point, maybe they would say, if they had faked this, you know what, this isn't worth the lie. All right, Jewish leaders, we've had our laugh, let's just call it a day. The only explanation that makes sense of the evidence is that Jesus really did rise from the dead, and it transformed these men from cowering in an upper room, too scared to even look in an empty tomb, to those who believed Jesus was risen from the dead and were willing to lay down their lives for that cause. I'm convinced the resurrection is true. Nothing else makes sense of the change in these disciples. Nothing else makes sense of the events on Easter Sunday. But so what? Who cares if Jesus did rise from the dead? I mean, it's an interesting fact. Well, what does it mean? Well, it means he really is God. It means he really did pay the price for sin. It means he really is going to raise us from our graves on the last day. It means this isn't just a story, but it's the most important historical fact of the past, the present, and the future. And Christians, we need to be like those disciples, like Mary. The Bible story isn't a film that you've liked and enjoyed, but you think it might be a little geeky, so you don't want to tell anyone else about. It's a real event that will really transform the lives of people around us. It's the most important event in history, and it should turn us from cowards into those who bravely declare the gospel as well. So we've learned six lessons from today's passage. Let me run you through them again. Jesus' burial proved he died. He really did give himself for sin. Jesus' burial fulfills the scriptures, showing God had always planned this in advance. Jesus' burial encourages risky discipleship, Joseph and Nicodemus setting us an example to be public in our faith in Jesus. And then there are three lessons from Jesus' resurrection. It was unexpected. It really happened. And it transformed those disciples from cowards into heroes. How will this resurrection transform you? Firstly, you might not yet be convinced. That's okay. It took a while for the disciples to come to that conclusion too. We just encourage you to look into this to see if it really is true. If it isn't, then you can write it off because it's based on history. But look at it. Examine it. See if there is another way to explain this evidence or whether Jesus really did rise from the dead. We're going to carry on looking at the resurrection over the next three Sundays, and you're more than welcome to join us. But perhaps you're growingly more convinced, yet you're nervous. Okay, maybe Jesus has risen from the dead, but what would people think if I said I was a Christian? What would my family think? What would my friends think? My colleagues think? I won't deny that being a Christian is sometimes hard, but the resurrection changes everything. If you know Jesus has risen from the dead, nothing can be more important than following him and preaching him to the world. Are any of you in this room a secret believer? Well, it's time to make that step that Nicodemus and Joseph made. To say, I believe Jesus rose from the dead. I believe he paid the price for my sins on the cross. I believe that one day he will rise me from my grave to live with him in eternal joy forever. And I believe this is the most important news in the world that everyone needs to hear. Finally, Christians, let's be encouraged to be more confident in our own faith. Christ is risen. And so it shouldn't be a secret. It should change everything. Whether you're saying it to your family members as you share Easter dinner today, whether you share it at the YP camp or some of the children's ministry, whether you're telling other people in your office, whatever opportunity you have, share this good news. Because it's not just some secret thing that you and I are interested in, like other people are interested in running or in history. It's the most important news in the world. Proclaim it, because it changes everything.